Well, we're going to finish up the part about our Lord Jesus Christ here in this series on suffering and deliverance. We've gone through 15 attempted murders of Christ in the last 3 weeks, really 16, I guess, if you count when he was a baby. And we're going to go through the remaining ones, and we're getting closer and closer to the end of his life. We're now going to begin at 2 days before the Passover, so this is just a few days before his death. And the wicked are still plotting and scheming and trying to kill him and have been unable to up until this point. So 2 days before the Passover, the chief priests and scribes and the elders assembled with Caiaphas the high priest, and they consulted how they might take Jesus by subtlety and craftiness and kill him. And we can read about that in Matthew 26, verses 1 through 4. Matthew 26, and verse 1 through 4. It says, "And it came to pass, when Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said unto his disciples, You know that after 2 days is the feast of the Passover, and the Son of Man is betrayed to be crucified. Then assembled together the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of the people unto the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and consulted that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him." So they again have this council, this meeting, and they've had a number of these. I haven't counted up how many meetings they've had, but this is a conspiracy by definition, when a group of people get together in secret and plan how they're going to do something evil, whether it's murder or something else. So they have been conspiring numerous times. And I think it's interesting here, and I never had noticed this until I heard John Yarsinsky up in Detroit. He did a sermon here a week or so ago, and this wasn't the topic of the sermon at all, but he mentioned about the high priest, how there were two at that time. There was Annas and Caiaphas, and I think Caiaphas was his son. But the point that he mentioned that I never had noticed is it says there they went under the palace of the high priest, and this is mentioned several times, the palace of the high priest. The high priest, under the law of Moses, certainly was not given a palace or anything like that. But this man had obviously enriched himself in the priesthood and had himself a palace to live in like a king. I mean, he basically had made himself like a king in Israel, which I thought was just interesting. This is certainly not how Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and Ithamar and the rest of those guys, they certainly didn't live in palaces, nor did God ever command that they would have one built for themselves. So I thought that was just something of note. So anyway, they all gather together at the palace. It says the rich hath many friends, and the high priest obviously did, all the scribes and Pharisees and elders and so on. So they get together, and they're going to kill him by craft and subtlety. It says subtlety there in Matthew 26, and if you go to Mark's account in Mark 14 and verse 1, it says here that they would take him by craft. Mark 14, 1, "After 2 days was the feast of the Passover and of unleavened bread, and the chief priests and the scribes sought how they might take him by craft and put him to death." Craft and subtlety, which are closely related. Subtlety is cunning, craftiness, guile. So they're synonyms, in other words. It's especially of a treacherous kind, guile or treachery. And then craft is intellectual power, skill. Like we talk about someone's craft, right? That they had some ability to do some type of work. It's called a craft. That's if you have the intellectual capability and the skill to do this endeavor. It's also skill, skillfulness, art, ability in planning or performing, ingenuity in constructing, dexterity. Now, that could be in a good sense, but in a bad sense, it is skill or art applied to deceive or overreach, deceit, guile, fraud, or cunning. So this is what those men were doing. They were trying to plan a deceitful and a deceptive way that they might catch Christ and kill him. And they're getting closer and closer to being able to do this. They're not quite there yet, but they're getting there. The reason they had to use craftiness and deception is because Jesus had done nothing wrong. So if somebody's done nothing wrong and there's nothing to charge him with, you've got to come up with something. And coming up with something and to try to make the story make sense and be consistent requires craftiness, right? You've got to have some wits about you to come up with a good lie that is not going to be obvious to those who you're trying to tell it to. But they decided not to try to kill him on the feast day because they feared the people. Matthew 26 and verse 5. Matthew 26, 5. But they said, not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar among the people. So they're trying to keep this thing under wraps because they are afraid of the people. And we've noticed this already. I'll just give you a couple of verses. If you go back to, or go forward to Mark 12 and verse 12, be back in time, but forward in the order of the books. In Mark 12 and verse 12, see here how they were afraid of the people. It says, and they sought to lay hold on him, but feared the people, for they knew that he had spoken the parable against them, and they left him and went their way. As I mentioned last time, when the government fears the people, there's liberty. When the people fear the government, there's tyranny. And in this case, they could not kill him because they were afraid of the people. They could create a riot. They take a guy that's really popular like Jesus and people know that he's healed people and that he's done nothing wrong, and they kill him, they stone him right in front of everybody. Chances are they're going to be the next ones to be stoned because people aren't going to tolerate that. And that's what they were afraid of. Look in Luke 20 and verse 19. I'll give you another example of this. Luke 20 and verse 19 says, and the chief priests and the scribes the same hour sought to lay hands on him, and they feared the people, for they perceived that he had spoken this parable against them, which is basically just a parallel text. But this is why, one of the reasons why governments fear the Bible, because the Bible exposes them, and the Bible shows us things just like that, that it's a good thing when the government fears the people. And that's why in the Soviet Union, the Bible was considered anti-communist literature. I'm reading the book that I finally gotten around to, The Persecutor by Sergei Kordakov. And when they would go and persecute Christians and they would break up their meetings and they'd have to root through their houses and look for Bibles and other religious material. And they got a Bible and confiscated it and they took the guy into jail. And he was in the police station and he was being interrogated and he asked, why is he here? And the man said, because you have anti-communist literature in your possession. He said, what literature? He said, the Bible. He's like, well, how's that anti-communist literature? And they said, well, it just is, because the Communist Party says it is. But here's one of the reasons why it's anti-communist literature, because it teaches that when governments fear the people, there is liberty, among many other things. But that's just one example. It also teaches people to obey God rather than men. And it teaches people to render unto God the things that are God and to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, right? I mean, so it doesn't teach unlimited obedience to the state. This Bible is definitely anti-communist literature. It also teaches personal property rights. Naboth, the Jezreelite, when the king wanted to take his vineyard, he said no, because that was his property that God gave him, right? So that's a whole sermon in itself. I'm not going to get into all that. But anyway, this, if you want the best anti-communist literature out there, right here, the King James Bible. And that's what got those Christians so mercilessly persecuted in the Soviet Union. So that was the 16th attempt on the life of Christ. And now they try again. Now the Passover is drawing nigh, and the chief priests and the scribes again seek how they might kill Jesus. So it's just one after another. At this point, it's pretty much every day they're getting together. They're plotting and scheming. If it doesn't work one day, they'll try it again the next day. Look at Luke 22, 1 through 2. Luke 22, 1 through 2. It says, now the feast of unleavened bread drew nigh, which is called the Passover. And the chief priests and scribes sought how they might kill him, for they feared the people. So there you go again. They're trying to figure out how they're going to do it without the people finding out. At this point, Satan enters into Judas, one of Christ's disciples, and he prompts him to go to the chief priest and offer to betray Christ to the chief priest for money. And this is often how persecution happens. It's through money. Turn with me to, actually you don't have to turn, it's verses 3 through 6. And then I'm going to give you another example from this book I'm reading about how there's nothing new under the sun. Luke 22, 3 through 6. Then entered Satan into Judas, surnamed Iscariot, being of the number of the 12, and he went his way and communed with the chief priests and captains how he might betray him unto them. And they were glad and covenanted to give him money, and he promised and sought opportunity to betray him unto them in the absence of the multitude. So yes, governments have been bribing people and paying people off to persecute the saints, well, for 2,000 years at least. And once again, that's what happened in the Soviet Union. The guy that wrote this book, Sergei Kordakov, he was a young man. He was taken into possession, the communists basically had him from 6 years old, is what I'm trying to say, in a communist school. And he grew up in it and rose up through the ranks in the system, even as a young man, and he ended up being the leader of the Communist Youth Party, or youth organization, or something like that. And because he did so well, when the Soviet Union in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, began to persecute the churches, they were looking for people that they could pay to go and to round these Christians up, beat them and torture them and so on. And he was chosen for this duty because he was good at what he did. He was young and strong and athletic, and he was a martial artist, and he was at the Naval Academy, and he was the leader of the youth there. Anyway, so he picks 20 some of his heartless, merciless friends, and they become this goon squad for the police in the Soviet Union. And they would be sent off on raids to go break up these church meeting places and beat the tar out of everybody and haul them into prison. And the reason he was able to do this, he would have never done this. He didn't have time to do it. But they were paying them big money, and I don't remember how many rubles, I think it was like 25 rubles per raid, when he was making 7 rubles per month. So he was making big money persecuting Christians, and that's why he and all of his friends would do it. And then the reason why they could find where these Christians were meeting, because they were meeting off in houses somewhere, a lot of times late at night or off in the forest in the middle of nowhere, the reason why they could find them is because they had informants and spies that they sent into these Christian groups. These people would pretend to be believers or pretend to be interested, and they would assemble together with the churches, and then they would rat them out to the authorities. And the reason why these people would do that is because they paid them. And they paid them even more than the raiders and the persecutors. They were paid very well. One of the reasons they were paid so well is because they had to continue to meet with the church and pretend to be Christians, and they didn't know when the raid was happening, and the people that were doing the raid didn't know who the spies were. So when they came in, those guys got their teeth knocked out too. They got the crap beat out of them too. So they had to risk that, and that's why they got paid so much money to do it. There's nothing new under the sun. These chief priests paid Judas to betray Christ, and that wicked Soviet government was paying spies to betray Christians there too. And, I mean, our government does it too. They pay protesters, they bust them in and pay them to come in and protest and loot. And, you know, all those riots that we had back in 2020, most of the people in those cities weren't from those cities. They were bussed in from other places, and they dropped big stacks of bricks, laid them throughout the city in strategic places so that they had bricks and rocks and everything to break the windows. They do the same thing today. They just haven't turned them against Christians yet. May God have mercy that they don't. So anyway, Judas betrays Christ for money. Now Judas, everybody thinks of him as this wicked, evil man, and he was. And we probably all think of him, if we don't know better, as He was the guy, he was the black sheep of the 12, and he was probably off to the side, and the other 11 didn't like him because they knew there was something shady about this guy, and he was just a wicked fifth column or something. And Jesus knew the whole time, and he was keeping his distance from him. You know what? That's not true. That's not true. At the Last Supper, Jesus said, one of you is going to betray me, and they're all like, is it me? Is it I? Is it I? They don't know who it is. And then John leans over on Jesus' bosom and says, who is it? He says, it's he to whom I give the sop to, and he dips the bread in the thing and he gives it to Judas. They had no idea that Judas was Judas. No clue. They thought Judas was just one of them. He's just like everybody else. Judas was actually a friend of Jesus Christ. Look at Matthew 26 and verse 50. Matthew 26 and verse 50. When Judas comes to him in the garden to betray him. And Jesus said unto him, friend, wherefore art thou come? Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and took him. Now when he said friend, I believe he was actually calling him a friend. You know, some people say, use that term, and they don't really mean it. You know, like, I can't think of an example at the moment. But a lot of times people say that. They'll speak to a group of people and say, call them friends, when they don't even know who they are, right? I mean, that happens all the time. I believe that Jesus was being sincere when he called him friend. And the reason I believe that is because it says in Psalm 41 and verse 9, which is a prophecy of Judas betraying Christ, it shows us here that Judas was a friend of Jesus Christ. Psalm 41 and verse 9. Psalm 41 and verse 9. It says, yea, mine own familiar friend, in whom I trusted, which did eat of my bread, hath lifted up his heel against me. And this verse is quoted in the Gospels, referring to Judas, whom Christ did eat bread with. And not just his friend, his own familiar friend, like a close friend, a friend that he knew very well, that was Judas. Sometimes the devil will use some of our closest friends to try to destroy us. It happened to me in Minneapolis, my closest friend in the church, the devil used to try to destroy me. And that hurts. It hurts when you're betrayed by your close friends. Well, they're still in the planning phase. They still haven't been able to kill him. And then once they arrest him, the chief priests and the elders and all the council, they seek for false witnesses to accuse him so that they could put him to death. So Judas paid them off, and then Judas, as we just read there, he goes and he leads them to the garden where Jesus is, and he betrays them, and they take Jesus. And I didn't read all that stuff, but you're familiar with it. And now they get him into before the council here, and they're going to try to set up false witnesses to put him to death. So they're getting very close at this point. Matthew 26 and verse 59. It says, now the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death. Of course, they had to have false witnesses, because there were no true witnesses. The man was sinless. He had never done anything wrong. He said to the Jews publicly, which of you convinceth me of sin? Convince means to convict. Come on, tell me. Give me instance right now, time and place. When have I ever sinned? They had nothing. So they had to make it up. They had to pay off people. They suborned witnesses to get them to testify things that were not true. They could only find two false witnesses, but their testimony did not agree together. Matthew 26 and verses 60 through 61. But found none. So they sought these false witnesses, but found none. Yea, though many false witnesses came, yet they found none. Yet found they none. at the last came two false witnesses. So these two were the only guys that even seemed credible at all. The rest of them were just making stupid stuff up, and nobody believed it whatsoever. And now they get these two false witnesses, and these guys actually know a few of the things that Jesus said, and they're going to be able to take what he said and try to twist it and make it stick. But their witness doesn't hold up either. And said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. And Jesus did say something similar to that. But we get a little more information in Mark, in chapter 14, verses 55 through 59, where we see that their witness did not agree together either. Mark 14, 55 through 59. And here in the Bible, we learn a little bit about proper jurisprudence. When you call witnesses to the stand, one of the things you try to do to see if they're telling the truth is to see if their witness agrees with other people's witness, or if it agrees with their own statements. You try to see if there's internal consistency in their own statements and with the statements of others. And anytime you see a contradiction, either within the person's own testimony or with the testimony of others, you know that somebody's lying. If he's contradicted himself, he's lying. If he's contradicted some other testimony, one of the two or both of them is lying. The Bible teaches us all kinds of things here. I think it's pretty interesting. Mark 14, 55 through 59. And the chief priests and all the council sought for witnesses against Jesus to put him to death, and found none. For many bear false witness against him, but their witness agreed not together. And there arose certain and bear false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. But neither did their witness agree together. So even these two witnesses, theirs didn't agree together either. So they've got nothing that will stick. They finally arrested him. They've got him in the court. They've got the witnesses against him. But all these guys are coming up and they're showing themselves to be perjurers. What are they going to do? So they finally just ask him if he's the Son of God. I mean, they're exasperated at this point, and they just want to, maybe you can just get him to say it right out of his own mouth. Matthew 26, 62 through 63. And the high priest arose and said unto him, answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee? But Jesus held his peace. And the high priest answered and said unto him, I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. So at this point, the high priest is just, he's baffled, he cannot understand. Jesus isn't even answering their false accusations, which, why would you? If your stupid enemies are discrediting themselves, why even waste your time to try to do it? Just let them do it themselves. And the high priest finally says, just tell us, I adjure thee in the name of God, are you the Christ, are you the Son of God, or not? And Jesus admits it. He tells him that he is. And this was enough for them to accuse him of blasphemy and be able to put him to death. Verses 64 through 66. Jesus saith unto him, thou hast said. That's a way of saying, yes, thou hast said. You said it, in other words. Thou hast said, nevertheless, I say unto you, hereafter shall ye see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest rent his clothes, saying, he hath spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? Behold, now ye have heard his blasphemy. What think ye? They answered and said, he is guilty of death. He finally got what he needed. Now he's got him on a charge of blasphemy. Now, it's not blasphemy if Jesus is actually the Christ, the Son of God. So really, they should not have accused him of blasphemy until they had proven that he's not the Son of God. If they had gone through the genealogical records and said, this guy is a son of a Moabite, right? He can't be the Christ. He's not even the son of David, right? Then they could have accused him of blasphemy. Or if they could have looked through the prophecies and said, he wasn't born in Bethlehem. You know, this guy was born up in Antioch or something, right? If they could have pointed to anything where he wasn't the Christ, or if they would have just looked at the time period and said, well, Daniel said it was 483 years, and it's only been 300 years, or whatever, right? Anything, any, if there was any discrepancy whatsoever where he did not fit the prophecies of the Old Testament of being the Messiah, then they could have accused him of blasphemy. But just simply because he came and said that I am the Son of God, and you're going to see me on the right hand of God someday, that's not blasphemy. Not if he is who he said he is. But the truth doesn't matter to these people. They just want something to make it stick. It's like the judge said to Stuart Crane years ago when he was on trial. He said, Crane, guilty or not, you're going to jail. It didn't matter. It didn't matter if he was guilty or not. They were going to find something in the kangaroo court to condemn him with, and this is exactly what the high priest is doing here. So they were close to being able to put him to death, but they're not yet able. And the reason is because the penalty for blasphemy was stoning, but God had decreed that Jesus would be killed by crucifixion. So this, he's not going to allow this to happen. The Jews didn't have authority to crucify him. As a matter of fact, it appears to me that they didn't have authority to put him to death, period. That the capital punishment was left up to the Romans and the Roman method. But the Jews, even if they did have a criminal that had committed something worthy of death, they weren't allowed to put him to death because the Romans were the rulers of the land at that time. The Jews had limited autonomy within that system, but anything big like a charge of murder, which would demand death, the Romans took care of that. Now I'll give you verses to prove all this. First of all, the penalty for blasphemy was stoning. Look at Leviticus 24 and verse 16. So they've got him, and they have, they believe, legal justification for putting him to death, but they still can't do it. Leviticus 24 and verse 16. It says, and he that blasphemeth the name of the Lord, he shall surely be put to death, and all the congregation shall certainly stone him, as well the stranger as he that is born in the land. When he blasphemeth the name of the Lord, shall he be put to death. Now, of course, Jesus didn't blaspheme. He didn't say anything blasphemous there whatsoever. But they accused him of blasphemy. And all they have to do is accuse him of it, and then have the people around saying, oh, he's guilty of death. And right there you have it. Accusation, the jury determines he's guilty, the facts of the case don't matter. But the thing is, even if he was guilty of blasphemy, the punishment for that is stoning, but little did they probably know that God had decreed that the Messiah was not going to be stoned. He was going to be crucified. And that was prophesied in the Old Testament. Luke 22 and verse 16 is the first place. Luke 22 and verse 16. The whole first half or so of this, almost first two-thirds of this psalm, is a prophecy of the suffering of Christ. And if you read through it, it will be very obvious and apparent to you that that's the case. And it says there in verse 16, Psalm 22, 16, He says, for dogs have compassed me. The assembly of the wicked have enclosed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. That's crucifixion. That's what happens when you're crucified. You have nails driven through your hands and your feet when they hang you on a cross. But that's not the only place where it was prophesied that Christ would die through crucifixion. In the book of Zechariah, in two different places, it is prophesied that Christ would be crucified. Zechariah 12 and verse 10. Zechariah is the second to last book of the Old Testament, just before Malachi. Zechariah 12 and verse 10 says, and I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplications, and they shall look on me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. Looking back on this prophecy, it is so obvious what it's talking about. Now, maybe it would have been not as straightforward and more confusing before the fact. But after the fact, is there any question what this is talking about? And this is a proof that Jesus Christ is God, because it says they will look upon me whom they have pierced, and it's the Lord speaking. It was Jesus Christ was the Lord that was pierced when they drove those nails through his hands and feet and pierced him with that spear. And he shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son. Christ was the only begotten Son of God that was pierced. And then over in the next chapter, in Zechariah 13, 6 through 7, it says, And one shall say unto him, What are these wounds in thine hands? Then he shall answer, Those with which I was wounded in the house of my friends. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, and against the man that is my fellow, saith the Lord of hosts. Smite the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered, and I will turn mine hand upon the little ones. What are these wounds in thine hands? He said he received them in the house of his friends. The house of Israel, in other words. He received them in the house of Israel. It says, Awake, O sword, against my shepherd. Jesus is called the chief shepherd when the chief shepherd shall appear. Awake against my shepherd, against the man that is my fellow. Jesus Christ, the Word made flesh, is the fellow of the Father. Saith the Lord of hosts, Smite the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. That verse is quoted in the Gospels when they took Jesus in the garden and everyone, all of his disciples, forsook him. And that verse is quoted, Smite the shepherd and the sheep shall be scattered. This is clearly a prophecy of the crucifixion of the Lord Jesus Christ. So this was the way it was going to happen. The Messiah was not going to be stoned or hanged or drowned or any other way. He was going to be crucified. But the Jews did not have authority to do that. Look in John 18, 31 through 32. John 18, 31 through 32. Then said Pilate unto them, Take ye him and judge him according to your law. The Jews therefore said unto him, It is not lawful for us to put any man to death, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spake, signifying what death he should die. They say it's not lawful. Pilate says, You put him to death. They're like, We can't do it. Now, I don't know if this was a Roman law that they couldn't do it, or they were just trying to pass the buck to Pilate because they didn't want to be responsible for his death. I'm not sure if they actually legally couldn't do it or if they just said they couldn't do it. But the fact is, they couldn't do it. And if they would have done it, it would have been by stoning. And that wasn't going to happen. The Lord would not allow it. And now we finally come to this last attempt when they are successful to kill the Lord Jesus Christ. It's the next morning. The chief priests and the elders gather a council together against Jesus to put him to death. Now, I was reading you the account there with Pilate. I was jumping ahead. This was that was not at the same time as what I was talking about there a minute ago. We'll get to that now. So in Matthew 27 and verse 1, they've put him on trial among the chief priests and the Jews. And he's been condemned to be put to death because of blasphemy. But they can't put him to death, so they have to bring him before Pilate. They got to take him before the Roman authorities to have him put to death. And they are finally successful at this time. Matthew 27 and verse 1 says, When the morning was come, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. I should have counted up the number of councils, but this has to be maybe the fifth or sixth or more time that they have held councils to plot the death of the Lord Jesus Christ. So they bound him and they took him to Pilate, who was the governor of the Jews at that time, verse 2. And when they had bound him, they led him away and delivered him unto Pontius Pilate, the governor. Then they accused him before Pilate. And Jesus answers nothing. And this is fascinating to me. Matthew 27 and verses 11 through 14. So I'm not going through this whole account or whole passage. I'm just hitting the high points. Matthew 27, 11 through 14. And Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, saying, Art thou the king of the Jews? And Jesus said unto him, Thou sayest. You said it, in other words. He's affirming, yes, I am the king of the Jews. And when he was accused of the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. Then said Pilate unto him, Hearest thou not how many things they witness against thee? And he answered him to never a word, insomuch that the governor marveled greatly. Pilate had never witnessed, I'm assuming, had never witnessed something like this before. He had never witnessed a man that is being accused of people, of crimes, and he doesn't even offer a defense for himself. He remained perfectly silent, answered them never a word. Just remember, I've said this many times before, you have the right to remain silent. Especially when you're arrested by the police, that is, that when they tell you that, listen to them. When they say you have the right to remain silent, and anything that you say can or will be used against you, not to exonerate you, it'll be used against you in the court of law, listen to them and keep your mouth shut. Don't say anything. Get an attorney. They tell you that for a reason. And it's not for your benefit. It's to cover their butts. But legally, according to the Miranda law, they have to tell you that. They're not doing it to be nice. You have the right to remain silent. But you also have the right to remain silent when somebody is attacking you. Like I told you the other day with the guy that attacked me. I didn't answer him. Not publicly, anyway. We had a little email exchange before he posted it all online, and I never answered him. I have the right to remain silent. I don't need to defend myself. I don't need to waste my time with somebody like that. Jesus Christ did the same thing. He's our example. Now, I'm not saying you couldn't defend yourself if you wanted to, but you don't have to. And sometimes, if you try to defend yourself, it just makes you look worse. Especially if you try to defend yourself against ridiculous false accusations. It just makes you look worse. Then people think, oh, this guy's got something to hide. Like Shakespeare said, methinks the lady doth protest too much. You want to be careful of that. Well, Pilate knew that they had delivered Jesus to him because of envy, and therefore he tried to release him. Pilate can see through this ruse. He realizes that this guy is not guilty. He hadn't done anything wrong. They have nothing on him. And like a good politician, he's trying to figure out a way to resolve this and not have the Jews go tattle on him to Rome or something. If he can figure out a way to let Jesus go and still maintain his position as governor, he's going to do it. But if it comes down to him losing his position as governor, he'll sacrifice Christ. He'll sacrifice anybody because he's a politician, and that's what politicians do. Verses 15 through 18. Now at the feast, the governor was wont to release unto the people the prisoner whom they would. And they had then a notable prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore, when they were gathered together, Pilate said unto them, Whom will ye that I release unto you, Barabbas or Jesus, which is called Christ? For he knew that for envy they had delivered him. He's got a notable prisoner. It says in another place he was there for sedition and murder. This is a really bad man. And so Pilate, and I think this is probably pretty wise on his part, he picks a really nasty prisoner and brings him forward and sets him next to Jesus and says, Who do you want me to release to you? This murderer and seditionist or this guy that's called Christ? And this really shows what's in their heart. Because they choose a murderer. They choose a wicked man like Barabbas to go free just so they can murder Christ. This just shows the envy that's in their hearts. It says, Wrath is cruel and anger is outrageous, but who can stand before envy? When somebody is willing to pick a murderer to make sure and ensure that you are put to death, yeah, who can stand before envy? That's It doesn't get much worse than that, does it? Well, the chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitude to ask for the murderer Barabbas to be released and Jesus to be destroyed. 19 through 22, Matthew 27, 19 through 21, pardon me. When he was set down on the judgment seat, his wife sent unto him, saying, Have thou nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him. But the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor answered and said unto them, Whether of the twain will ye that I release unto you? They said, Barabbas. This is the madness of crowds. The chief priest talks the crowd into saying they want Barabbas. And this just shows you the fickle-mindedness of people, the depravity of people, that people, especially crowds, can be so easily manipulated as to choose a murderer over a man that they themselves had watched for 3.5 years heal the sick, give sight to the blind, raise the dead, feed multitudes with a few loaves and fishes, all these amazing things, and teach them the most profound, beautiful words that they'd ever heard, and they could be persuaded to pick a murderer over him because crowds can be so easily manipulated. You got to be really careful. If you're in a crowd of people, some kind of a rally or something, be really careful to not let your emotions take over and just do whatever, you know, get all whooped up and then do whatever the leader is telling you to do. Like those idiots on January 6th that went and stormed into the Capitol building. Bunch of morons. It was stupid. They accomplished nothing and ended up suffering terribly for it. That was a dumb move. And why did they do it? Because there were a bunch of agent provocateurs in there that were instigating them and leading them in. You got to be really careful about stuff like that. Those poor guys, some of them are still rotting in prison just waiting for a trial over a year later. I mean, they may be dumb, but they don't deserve that. Not at all. I mean, what do they deserve? A trespassing charge. You know, a fine, whatever. A couple $100 or something. Whatever. You know, it was trespassing. That's all it was. If they damaged property, then they should be persecuted for that, or prosecuted for that, whatever. But it certainly wasn't sedition or anything else. But my point is with that, just be careful, because when you get in that moment and the whole crowd's heading into the Capitol building, what are you going to do? You're going to go right along with them. And you're going to think, oh, well, it's everybody. They can't arrest us all. Yeah, don't bet on it. They did arrest them all, or a lot of them anyway. Unbelievable how dumb people can be. But, you know, that's what happens when you have false ideas and false hopes, because most of those people probably bought into the propaganda that Trump was somehow going to take the election, that it was going to be overturned and Trump was going to be the president and they weren't going to get in any trouble. Well, if you were dumb enough to believe that, you're probably dumb enough to storm into the Capitol building and, wow, I feel bad for him, but there are consequences for stupidity. So they talked the crowd into calling for Barabbas. Now, when Pilate asked what he should do with Jesus, they cried that he should be crucified, verses 22 through 23. Pilate saith unto them, What shall I do then with Jesus, which is called Christ? They all say unto him, Let him be crucified. And the governor said, Why? What evil hath he done? But they cried out the more, saying, Let him be crucified. You cannot reason with a mob. Pilate says, What am I going to do to him? They say, Crucify him. He's like, But what evil has he done? And what is their answer? Crucify him. It doesn't matter what evil he's done. Crucify him. They said in another place, If he were not a malefactor, we wouldn't have delivered him to you. Pilate says, What'd he do? And they're like, Well, if he wasn't guilty, he wouldn't be here. Duh. What, you think we need charges or something? He's guilty. If he wasn't guilty, he wouldn't be in court. You know, that's what a lot of people think, right? They hear about somebody that's done something in the news and he's in court and they just assume he's guilty because he's in court. If he wasn't in court, or if he wasn't guilty, he wouldn't be charged with it. You want to be careful of that too. Yeah, a lot of times bad people end up in court and charged with crimes because they did the crimes. But we also have a system here where people are innocent until proven guilty. And whether you're a juror or just a bystander, you shouldn't assume that because somebody's been charged with something, they did it. And as a matter of fact, even when you see video of something, don't just assume that because you saw one video that the guy is guilty. I remember when the George Floyd thing happened, and I saw the video of Derek Chauvin with his knee on that guy's neck. And I concluded, like a fool, that guy murdered him. I saw it with my own eyes. I didn't see the other videos. I didn't know that George Floyd was hopped up on fentanyl and three times the lethal dose of fentanyl, and he's hyperventilating, and he asked them to take him out of the cruiser and to put him on the ground. He asked to be on the ground, and that's their policy, which is probably dumb, but that's their policy, to put the knee on the guy's neck. He didn't die of asphyxiation. According to the coroner's report, he died of an overdose of fentanyl. But I didn't know that. It just looked like, oh, the officer's got his knee on his neck and he stops breathing and he dies. Not to mention he had heart problems and all kinds of stuff. Be very careful. I learned my lesson. I hope I learned my lesson from that situation. And I hope I never repeat that again, that even if I see a video, I mean, unless it is just blatantly obvious, do not pass judgment until that thing goes through a court and a jury hears both sides of it and decides it. And the jury could be wrong too, but at least then, if you've heard both sides of the argument, then you can make a determination. Don't make a determination based on a lack of information. He that answereth a matter before he heareth it, it's folly and shame unto him. You'll make yourself look like a fool. But a mob cannot be reasoned with. And let me tell you what, right here, this is democracy in action. This is democracy in action. Pilate's got a whole group of people before him, and he says, what should be done to him? And the majority say, crucify him. And that's that. In a democratic system, majority rules. If you have a pure democracy, 51% of the people decide what to do. And you know what that means? It means 51% of the people can choose to oppress and persecute the other 49%. And there's nothing they can do about it. There's no protection for minorities in a democracy. A democracy is the most evil, wicked form of government ever devised by mankind. Our founding fathers thought that. Because in a pure democracy, there are no checks on the will of the people. I think it was Ben Franklin said, one of the founders, I forget which one, they said democracy is two wolves and a sheep deciding what's going to be for dinner. That's democracy. Our founders did not create a democracy. They created a republic, a constitutional republic. There's a big difference. Most people weren't even allowed to vote. You know, the people think the founders created a democracy. Women weren't allowed to vote. That's half the population right there. It's not a democracy when half the population can't vote. Of course, the slaves couldn't vote, right? That's another big chunk of the population. People that weren't at least 21 years of old couldn't vote. That's another big chunk of the population. People that weren't landowners couldn't vote. That's another big chunk of the population. People that were illiterate couldn't vote. That's some of the population, because states had polling requirements that you had to pass a litmus test or a reading test. You had to pay a poll tax to vote. All kinds of things. The founding fathers did not set up a democracy. They wanted a literate, educated, wise electorate, a relatively limited group of people, to choose the leaders, because the rest of the people are too dumb to do it. And that's just a fact. The president wasn't popularly elected. The Electoral College elected the president. And the Electoral College doesn't have to follow the popular vote. You know that, right? They don't have to if they don't want to. The senators were not popularly elected. They were chosen by the states. The state governments appointed the senators until 1913 when they amended the Constitution to make senators popularly elected. The president, the Senate were not popularly elected. The only ones that were popularly elected was the Congress. The other branches weren't. The judges are appointed. The founding fathers did not create a democracy on purpose. They wanted to protect the rights of the people, and especially minorities. If you're a minority in a democracy, you are in big trouble. So that's why it really irks me every time I hear most of these leftists out there talking about our democracy, our democracy. They're attacking our democracy. We don't have a democracy, or it's getting closer to that, but we shouldn't have one. We didn't have one originally. But this is democracy in action right here. You got a mob, and you say, what are we going to do? And the majority of them say, kill them. Well, the people have spoken. What are you going to do? Well, Pilate tried to absolve himself from any guilt prior to scourging Jesus and delivering him to be crucified, as if this is going to work before God or something, where Pilate can get up to the judgment seat someday and say, well, Lord, you know, I did wash my hands of the matter. Yeah. We'll see how that one works out. Verses 24 through 26. Then Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but that rather a tumult was made. He took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent from the blood of this just person. See ye to it. Then answered all the people and said, his blood be on us and on our children. Then released he Barabbas unto them, and when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. So he is going to wash his hands of this matter. That was a symbolic way of saying, you know what? I'm not responsible for this. I'm giving the order, but I'm not responsible for it. Yeah, right. You are. And the scripture lays the responsibility of the crucifixion of Christ not only on the Jews that instigated it, but on Pilate and on Herod, on the people, on the rulers, on everybody involved. And they said, his blood be on us and on our children. And boy, has that prophecy ever come true. Because those people have suffered. They suffered in 70 AD, and the ones that were scattered have suffered for hundreds of years, thousands of years. And they've inflicted plenty of suffering themselves on other people, I hasten to add. Well, after putting a crown of thorns on his head, mocking him, spitting on him, and beating him, they crucified Jesus. Verses 27 through 34. And then verse 35. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the common hall and gathered unto him the whole band of soldiers, and they stripped him and put on him a scarlet robe. And when they had plaited a crown of thorns, they put it upon his head and a reed in his right hand, and they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews. Not only would that hurt, you know, a crown of thorns, just having thorns pressed down in to your head. You got a lot of blood vessels in your head. You ever see somebody, I mean, they get a head wound, like in a car accident or something? I mean, there's blood all over, I mean, just gushing all over their head because you got all those blood vessels real close to the skin. That crown of thorns, he would have blood running down his face, and they put a reed in his hand like it's some kind of a scepter or something, to, you know, just to mock him, to make fun of him. It would have been physically painful, and it would have been very emotionally painful. Verse 30, and they spit upon him and took the reed and smote him on the head. I honestly think that would probably be the worst part of the whole deal, is being spit upon. Having some nasty dude spit in your face. That would be one of the most horrible things. It wouldn't hurt physically, but it would be one of the most disgusting things. Very ignominious. And after that, they had mocked him. They took the robe off from him and put on put his own raiment on him, and led him away to crucify him. And as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name, him they compelled to bear his cross. Talk about being at the wrong place at the wrong time. He ends up bearing this cross the whole way up to Golgotha. I don't know how long it was, but I'm sure that cross was very heavy, and he ended up carrying that thing. And when they were come unto the place called Golgotha, that is to say, a place of a skull, they gave him vinegar to drink, mingled with gall, and when he had tasted thereof, he would not drink. And they crucified him, and parted his garments, casting lots, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophets. They parted my garments among them, and upon my vesture did they cast lots. They finally have done it. They've crucified him. They've been working at this for 3.5 years. About 20 different times they had planned and plotted or just outright tried to physically kill him and could not do it. And they've finally succeeded. And after Jesus suffered the wrath of God for a few hours on the cross, for several hours, he died. Matthew 27 and verse 50. And Jesus, when he had cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost. They'd finally won, so they thought. What they didn't realize is that it was their undoing. Had they known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But none of the previous attempts at murdering Christ were successful, because God had determined that he would be killed in a certain way, at a certain time, at a certain place. And only that way, that time, and that place. And he would not allow it, and did not allow it, as we've seen, any other way. Turn with me to Luke 22:22. I'll give you a few verses here. This is the sovereignty of God. Nothing is going to happen in this world without God at a minimum permitting it. Let's say prevent. Without him permitting it. Or just outright causing it if he chooses to. Nothing's going to happen without him allowing it. Luke 22 and verse 22. Jesus said, "And truly the Son of Man goeth as it was determined, but woe unto that man by whom he is betrayed." As it was determined. And you look up the word determined, and it means to set limits and bounds on something. It was determined. God had put bounds and limits on how he would be put to death. It wasn't going to happen by being thrown headlong over a cliff. It wasn't going to happen by stoning. It wasn't going to happen by any of the rest of the ways that they tried to do it. And it wasn't going to happen at those times. It was going to happen by crucifixion on the very day that the Lord had determined that it would happen. It was determined. Look at Acts 2 and verse 23. Acts 2 and verse 23. It says, "Him," speaking of Christ, "being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, ye have taken and by wicked hands have crucified and slain." He was delivered by the determinate counsel of God. God planned how it would happen by putting bounds and limits on the will and works of men, to only allow it to happen as he wanted it to happen. I'll give you one more. Acts 4, 25 through 28. "Who by the mouth of thy servant David hath said, why did the heathen rage and the people imagine vain things? The kings of the earth stood up, and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ. For of a truth against thy holy child Jesus, whom thou hast anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate with the Gentiles and the people of Israel were gathered together for to do whatsoever thy hand and thy counsel determined before to be done." That's what you call predetermination, determined before to be done. And we watched how the Lord did it, just guiding them along, stopping them here, stopping them there. Keep moving forward until you finally get to that day, to that method of his death. And then it happens. So Satan and his followers tried 18 times to kill Jesus before finally being successful on the 19th attempt. God delivered him from death each time until the appointed time and manner of his death was come. And after Jesus was killed, God raised him from the dead and set him at his own right hand, far above all principalities and powers. Now we're skipping ahead here in time. I don't have time to preach on the whole death, burial, and resurrection of Christ this morning, but we just get to the good part, and that's in Ephesians 1, 20 through 23. Because remember, the point of the sermon is suffering and deliverance. Here's the deliverance. God delivered him all those times from death, and then when he finally dies, God delivers him again from the grave to the right hand of God in heaven, ruling and reigning over the entire universe. Now that's a deliverance there, I would say, wouldn't you? Ephesians 1, 20 through 23, which he wrought in Christ when he raised him from the dead and set him at his own right hand in the heavenly places, far above all principality and power and might and dominion and every name that is named, not only in this world, but also in that which is to come, and hath put all things under his feet and gave him to be the head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him that filleth all in all. Yes, he suffered. And yes, he was delivered miraculously. All right, there are some lessons that we can learn from this. Interestingly enough, and I don't think I did this on purpose, there were 19 attempts at his life, and there are 19 lessons we can learn from this. And I'll get through these pretty quickly. I don't have verses for all of them or for hardly any of them. Lesson number one. Let me get a drink of water before I stirred into this. Lesson number one. Religious people, specifically professing Christians, will often be our greatest persecutors. Our greatest persecutors will often be professing Christians. You've probably experienced this in your own life. When you were first converted and you stopped celebrating Christmas and you started going to some little church that people think is a cult and things like that, who are the ones that gave you the most grief in your life? Was it your atheist secular boss that couldn't care less? Or was it your parents, children, brothers and sisters, family members, people that are closest to you, right? The ones that profess to be Christians, especially. They're the ones. That's what happens. Jesus said, a man's foes shall be they of his own household. And it's universal. I think every one of us have probably experienced that to one extent or the other. I've gotten, and who do I get the most trouble from my teaching? Who do I get the most hate mail from? It's certainly not atheists. I have gotten, when I did do some videos attacking atheists or attacking their position, I did get a lot of hate mail from them at the time. But if you leave them alone, they leave you alone, generally speaking. Who do I get all the hate mail from? Professing Christians. Not atheists or agnostics. Now, that's not always the case. I was talking about the Russian persecution in the Soviet Union. They were atheists, and the persecution of Christians there was not from fellow Christians whatsoever. Wasn't from Catholics or anything. You know, a lot of times through history, it's been the Catholics that were persecuting the Christians. But not in the Soviet Union. It was atheist, godless people that were persecuting. But who was Jesus persecuted by? Not by the Romans, not by the pagans, right? By the Jews, by the Pharisees, by the religious leaders of the day. That's who he was persecuted by. And it's no different today. Lesson number two. There is a time to fight and a time to flee. How many times do we see Jesus flee? He fled. He got himself away. Right? There's a time to fight and there's a time to flee. Wisdom will direct which time is which. It's not always wise to fight, but it's also not always wise to flee. It just depends. Lesson number three. No good deed goes unpunished by the wicked. Some of the times they tried to kill Jesus, it was because he healed on the Sabbath day. He did some good thing and they tried to kill him for it. Don't be surprised if you do some good thing and somebody attacks you for it. It happens. Lesson number four. God will not allow our persecutors to be successful in their persecution of us if it's not his will. And that's kind of the overarching lesson in the persecution of Christ here. He will not allow them to be successful in their persecution if it is not his will. So you just want to remember that. If you are being persecuted successfully in your suffering, do you know why? It's because it's the will of God. How do I know that? Because if it wasn't the will of God, it wouldn't be happening. That's why. Now, as to why God allows some people to be persecuted and some people not to be, that's a question you're going to have to ask him, not me. As I'm reading this book, The Persecutor, and it is going through my mind, why? Why, Lord? Why did those people over there get brutally beaten and endure so much pain, and I have endured nothing? Nothing in comparison. Why? I don't know. But God knows. He knows what he's doing. Lesson number 5. Don't be afraid to rebuke your persecutors when necessary. Jesus did. You know, when they were persecuting him and he condemned them for it. Not every time. Sometimes he remained silent. So it's, I'm not saying always to do that. But sometimes it's okay to rebuke your persecutors. Lesson number 6. There's a time to lay low and not to antagonize our enemies. You know, Jesus didn't go down to the feast at first. He stayed back. He hung out in Galilee because the Jews were trying to kill him. There's a time to lay low. Lesson number 7, there's a time to be confrontational, but not every time. There are times. Sometimes Jesus was confrontational. He didn't hold back, and he went on the offensive. But you don't have to do that every time. A lot of the problems that we face are really of our own making. And then we like to turn around and say, well, I don't go looking for problems. They come looking for me. That's what I used to say when I was first converted. I tell people, I don't go looking for controversy. It comes looking for me. I think there was a little of me going looking for controversy. I got into arguments with a lot of people about doctrine when I was first converted. And that's typical of people that are newly converted. Lesson number 8. Our enemies will try divers methods of persecuting us. I mean, think about how many times they tried with Jesus. Throw him down over a cliff, stone him, try to catch him in his words, try to catch him telling people not to pay their taxes so they can turn him into Caesar. All kinds of things. If they can't get you one way, they'll try another. So just because you've successfully resisted some type of temptation or persecution, don't think it's over. Right? Satan's got all kinds of ideas up his sleeve. Lesson number 9. If we speak the truth meekly, we can sometimes win over our persecutors. You remember the officers that they sent to get Jesus and bring him back? And they went and they listened to him and they come back without him. And the Pharisees are like, where is he? And they're like, never man spake like that man. You never know. Speak meekly. You might just win them over. Lesson number 10, there is a time to hide. You know, we read about Jesus hiding himself. And when we get to the Apostle Paul here in a few weeks, we're going to see that he hid himself. Now, I'm not talking about cowering in fear in our homes, not assembling together. That's not what I'm talking about. We can hide ourselves where we, if we have to, we can meet different places. Go off in the woods. You know, that's what the Russians were doing. This persecutor, they went out and persecuted these people at a baptism out in the middle of the forest, way out in the middle of nowhere. They were off hiding. You know, when it said, the Bible says, when the wicked rise, a man hideth himself, or hides himself. Lesson number 11. Many are the afflictions of the righteous. That's from the Psalm. Psalm 30 or 34, I think it is. The rest of that verse says, but the Lord delivereth him out of them all. But yes, we have many afflictions being the children of God. It's not a one and done. I think sometimes we think that, especially people right after their conversion, they suffer. Like I suffered a lot, right? Shortly after my conversion. And then you think, got that over with. The rest of life's going to be all right. Then you realize, oh, yeah, there's just more. It's kind of, you ever hear the joke that the Calvinist tripped and fell down the stairs and he got up and he said, glad that's over with. Everything's predestined, right? Get it? Oh. Lesson number 12. Don't be afraid to boldly preach the gospel even when you know you will be persecuted for it. That didn't stop Jesus. He knew they were after him. He knew they were waiting for him. And he did it anyway. He just kept preaching. Don't let them stop you. If you stop preaching because somebody's persecuting you and you silence yourself, they have won. Lesson number 13. It helps to have friends in the community so that persecutors in government will be hesitant to provoke the public to anger. That's an important thing. That's one of the reasons, not the only reason, but that's one of the reasons that I've made friends with the local pastors here in town, some of them. I go out to lunch with them once a month. And it's not like I'm doing it just for that reason. I enjoy talking with those guys, a lot of them. But it's a good idea to know the people in your local community. And if people know you and they know that you're a decent individual, if all of a sudden the government comes after us, and you got a bunch of other people around the community, and they're going to say, what are you persecuting those people for? They didn't do anything wrong. These are good people. Right? That's why I go to the horribly boring city council meetings occasionally and offer the opening prayer for them. Not because I like city council meetings. I'd rather gouge my eyeballs out with a spoon. But I go there because people in the city council might eventually get to know me, and then someday, whenever some authority is giving me trouble, they can say, well, wait a minute, I know that guy. He prayed before our city council meetings. Why are you giving him a hard time? Doing it for my own self-preservation. I just have to learn to keep my mouth shut at the city council meetings and not thank the conservatives publicly in front of the mayor for trying to resist what she's trying to do. I got to remember to keep my mouth shut about that. Lesson number 14. Be careful what you say when you have enemies because they will use your words against you. This is one of the things they tried to do with Jesus. They watched him to catch him in his words. Then they'd ask him questions. Oh, Master, we know that you're a good teacher and you don't show respect to persons and, you know, you teach the way of God and truth. Is it lawful to give tax money to Caesar or not, you know? Try to catch him in his words. You got to be really careful. If you know you have enemies, watch what you say. Measure your words because they will definitely be used against you. Lesson number 20. Our enemies will use subtlety and deceit to persecute us. Just like I told you about those spies in Russia. You know, those poor Christians there would be meeting and some guy would come in and pretend to be a new convert or interested in the truth. I just want to know about Jesus. I want to learn. And he's a fifth column, right? He's being deceitful so that they can persecute. Lesson number 16. Sometimes the devil will use our closest friends to try to destroy us. Just like Judas, just like Ahithophel with David, his trusted counselor turned on him. That happens. Like I said, I've had it happen to me. You have one of your closest friends turn on you. It's very painful. Lesson number 17. The devil will use false witnesses to falsely accuse us to get us in trouble with the law. That's ultimately what they tried to do to Christ. Try to get him in trouble with the law. Bring him before Pilate. make these accusations. Lesson number 18. God will allow our persecutors to afflict us and even kill us if it is His will. If it is His will, He does allow that. You read about martyrs in the book of Revelation. I mean, you read about martyrs in the Bible. John the Baptist, Jesus Christ, James, Herod killed with the sword. Peter was in prison numerous times. Paul was in prison numerous times. They stoned Stephen, right? Sometimes God allows our persecutors to afflict and even kill us if it's His will. And lesson number 19. Ultimately, though, even if we are killed, we will be victorious over death. I'll just give you a few verses and we'll be done. Revelation 12 and verse 11. Honestly, if you go read like Fox's Book of Martyrs and books like that, and you read about what Christians endured, you'd be praying for death if you were ever persecuted when you see what some of those people endured. Death would be not a bad thing whatsoever. Revelation 12 and verse 11. And they overcame Him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. Yeah, they were willing to give their lives and to die for Christ, and they overcame in that. Through death, they overcame because they went to death in faith. Faith is the victory that overcometh the world, we're told in 1 John. Look in Revelation 2 and verse 10. Revelation 2 and verse 10. The Lord tells this church in Smyrna, fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. And I tell you today, I've been talking a lot about suffering and persecution, and I say the same thing. Fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. If God so be, if God has determined to let you suffer in your life at some point, don't fear those things. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison. He may cast some of us into prison. That could very well happen. That ye may be tried, and ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee the crown of life. If that ever happens to you, you just be faithful. You go to prison faithfully. You just trust God, and you'll get a crown of life. One more, 1 Corinthians 15, 54 through 55. I'll bet you that's what some of those Russian preachers were preaching to their church. I know I would have been if I was in that situation. At least I think I would have been. 1 Corinthians 15, 54 through 55. So when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? Let me tell you what, when you're killed and you breathe your last, it's victory. You get victory over death because now you're in heaven and your suffering's over. I keep talking about these Russians, and I will keep talking about them because it's all fresh in my mind. They went and broke up that one meeting where there was a pastor that was going to baptize 7 people. And they stormed, rushed in before he even got to baptize them, and went out there with a big baton and some reprobate hit the pastor over the head with that. It was a steel baton, killed him instantly, just crushed his skull, and he floated down the river, and they found him later. But you know what? That pastor went to heaven that very day. Death was swallowed up in victory. Death no more had a claim on him. He had no worries. He went to be with the Lord Jesus. The same thing will happen to us if that happens to us, God forbid. Next time we'll pick it up and we're going to look at the story of Peter being cast into prison and being delivered from the prison. And there's going to be some interesting lessons in that one as well, Lord willing.
Just a quick note at the end of the sermon. The most important thing a believer in Jesus Christ can do is to be a member of one of God's true churches. If you're not already a member of one, go to pastorwagner.com/churches. To see if there is a true church or other believers of like faith near you. That's pastorwagner.com/churches.